This is Audible.
The struggle which saw the birth of the United States of America from the expanding body of the late 18th century British Empire was a long and bloody affair. Its roots were traditionally seen in the oppressive control of the mother country and the burdensome taxation regime imposed on the American colonies. But how far is that view accurate? Were taxes a legitimate excuse for political protest and rebellion? Or was this a case of the colonies pushing for liberty? To what extent was emerging American nationalism a driving force for independence? And how far did Enlightenment thinking stir a sense of entitlement for independence? As to the war itself, how far was the British defeat due to political and military incompetence, which saw the British effort crumble in the face of the qualities of American high command? Washington's leadership has often been highlighted as a significant factor in the victory of the colonists. But perhaps this is an exaggerated view, born from the early republic's desire to create national icons. Finally, what of the new, loud, emerging set of republican states after the British defeat? How far did they and their Congress constitute a united nation? And what were its strengths as it entered a new century, leading a new force onto an increasingly revolutionary world stage?
Hello, welcome to Audio Pie's series for A-level students studying the American Revolution from 1740 to 1796. In this first podcast, we're going to introduce the major issues and themes that will be developed in the rest of the series. These are the development of British hegemony in America, the causes of the American Revolution between 1774 and 1783, the Early Republic 1783 to 1796. This pod will provide you with an introduction and overview of these four themes, from the time of British control to the early years of the American Republic.
We will examine the nature of the relationship between Britain and the 13 colonies in the period leading up to the Revolution. How far can the roots of the Revolution be traced to the period of British control between 1740 and 1763? How strong was colonial government in this period, and how far did Britain govern the colonies politically and economically? What was life like in the colonies, and to what extent were attitudes towards Britain uniform? Certainly the geography of the American colonies deserves some attention if we are to understand the nature of the relationship with the Crown.
Outside events and powers also had their part to play in this story, with particular attention needing to be cast upon Britain's wars with France, especially the impact of the War of Austrian Succession and the Seven Years' War, which manifested themselves in distinctive ways in the American colonies. European diplomacy and imperial policy was influenced by Native American conflicts in the interior, while French and Indian wars allowed British redcoats and some of the Revolution's American generals to cut their military teeth.
Economics and political ideology play a large role in this story, and it is fascinating to see how issues of liberty and taxation came under scrutiny, as the British imperial system, known as mercantilism, sought to better control the mixed-up economies of the colonies prior to the Revolution. Who really controlled economic development and exercised authority has led to lots of debate, and the traditional view that empire-hindered progress has been revised, which raises questions about why the Revolution really broke out.
If the relationship between Britain and the colonies was reasonably close in 1760, divisions certainly began to appear by 1763. We must examine British policies throughout the 1760s and investigate their impact on the colonies to see whether mistakes were made by the British government. Were the Americans oppressed by British taxes, and if so, in what ways? Was the presence of the British Army in the colonies a major factor in causing resentment, particularly when coupled with the costs of housing them? Certainly these issues caused resentment, but George III's 1763 proclamation saw an overt interference in American expansion, which signalled a shift from Britain's previously hands-off governance, sometimes called salutary neglect.
The reaction to British policymaking should also be seen in a wider framework of Enlightenment political thought. This was the age of reason, and several individuals stirred a revolutionary response to imperial control, drawing on earlier thinkers such as John Locke. Was there an ideological impetus for the reaction against British rule? We will examine the role of writers such as John Dickinson, Thomas Paine, Thomas Jefferson, and John Adams, amongst others. To what extent did their influence drive colonists to question imperial control?
And what of the war itself? We'll be looking at the reasons for the British loss. How far was the war lost because of poor generalship and political weakness at home? Was there a will to win from all quarters? And did public opinion support the war in America? Did the British plan effectively? And how far was the strategy employed fully understood by all generals? King George III certainly felt that there was a lack of discipline in the army and a lack of unity at home. However, fighting a war 3,000 miles away from home was a significant logistical exercise, and perhaps the remote nature of this conflict was as much to blame as military and political leadership. It is also necessary to ask whether Britain could have continued the war after Yorktown with a strong foothold in a number of strategically important regions. Was it a question of simply losing the will to fight?
Alternatively, many historians have preferred to concentrate on the colonists, the patriots, rather than looking at the British weaknesses. How far was this an American victory? Were the Americans united by nationalistic fervour to drive out the oppressive British? Did the Continental Army gradually improve under the stewardship of Washington? Or were other commanders and local militia units equally important? Certainly his career in the Revolution was not without setbacks, and Congress questioned his command regularly. Just as certain was the importance of French involvement in the war, as they and other powers threw in their might against the British military.
And what of the emerging embryonic republic? Was it well governed? Were the Articles of Confederation sufficient to govern a new nation? Many saw them as merely ties of friendship, which may have been sufficient during the war with Britain, but afterwards meant that the government lacked legitimacy, with no head of state. But where did power lie? What was the nature of the problems facing those tasked with running this new major country, and how could they be overcome? Certainly, the new government had significant financial problems, which needed a coordinated response.
As Congress battled with the issues of a newly formed country and governmental system, we will look at the early responses to the questions posed. How far were the changes made at the Philadelphia Convention in 1787 a move towards stable national government? The Founding Fathers have been credited with saving or finishing the Revolution by some authors, introducing a constitution with clear separation of powers. But their actions were not universally approved, and a strong anti-federalist movement emerged, splitting people across the country into two camps.
The early republic saw a great number of changes. The role of the president gradually emerged, shaped by the actions of Washington, who carved out a role for the cabinet as his advisors. He was supported by able men, including Alexander Hamilton, whose work helped America's economy to flourish, whilst at the same time opening up political divisions between the North and the South. We will examine the rise of the Republicans and the Federalists, and the splits between Jefferson and Hamilton.
Finally, we will look at the broad themes of the period. How revolutionary was the American Revolution? How far did the founding fathers cement the positions of a wealthy elite? Or did they enable a social revolution in America? How democratic was America by 1796, a word which was still suspiciously viewed? The American Revolution was a defining moment in global history, whose legacies were profound, and whose groundbreaking documents and geopolitical fractures still resonate, of course, in the shape of the world today.
We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Welcome to Pod 2 of The American Revolution, 1740 to 1796, in which we're going to outline the position of Britain's mainland colonies at the start of our period, and think about how far the million or so Americans who lived there possessed a distinct social or political identity. National identity is a complicated thing, an imagined community, as Benedict Anderson described in 1983. It's something as much in our heads as in our homes, possessions, or behaviours. When we examine the colonial American world of 1740 to 1760, we find very few people thinking of themselves as Americans, and lots of people buying into Britishness. We also expose how much variation there was across the colonies in terms of mixes of people, economic products, religious practices, and social pastimes.
In spite of all this variation, there were still important common features, many of them relating to colonial structures and how they connected with Britain and with one another. For one thing, they had all been growing rapidly, had all been involved in claiming lands from Indians by military or economic pressure, had all developed their own regional economies that profited from producing raw materials and shipping goods to other parts of the Atlantic world. And as they developed, they had all evolved a kind of matching political shape that allowed them to exercise local power while still being connected to British imperial authority.
True. So perhaps the best way to think about the colonies overall is that they are sprawling, varied, and they are autonomous, but that they also share pretty firm political shapes and strong cultural and economic links with the mother country.
Yes. We are not dealing with two matching power blocks that are going to clash, but a configuration like a wagon wheel, with Britain and Britishness at the centre, and the spokes each leading off to different colonies, which share points of connection, but are still discrete. We can get a flavour of this by dipping into the journal of Alexander Hamilton, a Scottish doctor who emigrated to Maryland in 1738 to take advantage of American opportunities. He recorded his thoughts after extensive travelling. Here's how he described Philadelphia, the city in which the Declaration of Independence would be signed some 32 years later.
Wednesday, June 6, 1744. The country round the city of Philadelphia is level and pleasant, having a prospect of the large river of Delaware and the province of East Jersey upon the other side. At my entering the city, I observed the regularity of the streets, but at the same time, the majority of the houses mean and low, and much decayed. The streets in general not paved, very dirty and obstructed with rubbish and lumber, but the frequent building excuses that. The State House, Assembly House, the Great Church in Second Street, and Whitefield's Church are good buildings.
Notice how he characterizes the lands in these middle colonies as fertile, busy, and giving glimpses of both poverty and affluence, especially in the public buildings like the churches and political chambers. How did he characterize the people?
In the afternoon, I went to the coffee house, where I was introduced to several gentlemen of the place,
where the ceremony of shaking of hands, an old custom peculiar to the English, was performed with great gravity and the usual compliments. I dined at a tavern with a very mixed company of different nations and religions. There were Scots, English, Dutch, Germans and Irish. There were Roman Catholics, Anglican churchmen, Presbyterians, Quakers, New Lightmen, Methodists, Seventh-day men, Moravians, Anabaptists, and one Jew. The whole company consisted of 25, planted around an oblong table in a great hall well stocked with flies.
Pennsylvania, like many other parts of the colonies, was a mixed-up place, and besides the blend of Europeans, there were large numbers of Africans, Native Americans, and people of mixed race, with many slaves who did the hardest jobs on the docks or in the fields. The further south you travelled through British America, the greater concentrations you were likely to find of slaves, as the warmer southern colonies relied upon plantations to grow valuable crops such as tobacco, rice, and indigo that helped to fund the luxurious lifestyles of the elites and to drive forward the Atlantic economy.
The major seaports like Philadelphia, Boston, New York, and Charleston were among the largest towns in the British Empire and depended on their mercantile activity and seaborne commercial traffic. The colonies then faced outward, exchanging goods with one another in a system notionally controlled by Britain's customs officers and protected by her navy. Beyond the south, in the rich river valleys of the middle colonies and the busy townships of New England, the economy was more diversified, producing enough subsistence products, among them wheat, livestock and lumber, to comfortably feed themselves and to provision the West Indies islands, who in turn exploited Africans, to generate wealth from sugar production.
The cultural character of the different colonies varied just as much as their populations and reflected the old world communities that they had come from. There were echoes of Puritan East Anglia, urban Londoners, Ulster folk, Germans, Dutch, and everything in between. But each colony had developed a kind of format of government that had common features. By the mid-18th century, the colonies were typically each run by their own assemblies, made up of elected free men, who passed laws that applied in their provinces. These legislatures were fiercely protective of their liberties and rights, including their right to pass local taxes. But their authority was moderated by a small appointed council, usually around a dozen wealthy elites, and by the royal governor, who was the main representative of the king in each colony, appointed directly by His Majesty and reporting back to his ministers and the Board of Trade. Some provinces had never fully switched to royal control and retained older charters or remained under proprietors, as in the case of Pennsylvania, but all were subject to the imperial economic controls.
Colonial politics in America tended to involve an awkward dance then between the needs of local assemblies and the priorities of the royal governors and their officers. Colonial expansion occurred when relations were managed well, salaries paid and taxes collected. There was little interference from the British Crown when things went well, and especially when one reached the more interior colonies close to the Appalachian interior. The wilderness was never far away for colonial Americans, and the thick woods and Indians on their western frontiers, along with the many slaves among them and the absence of an aristocracy, were among the features that made their lives different from other imperial subjects. They knew their circumstances were somehow less English than their counterparts, but perhaps partly because of this, several historians have noted how they sought to prove their gentility and celebrate their Britishness. In the middle years of the century, they did this particularly in their buying patterns and their reading patterns.
When he wasn't practicing medicine in Maryland, our traveller Hamilton wrote for his local newspaper, the Maryland Gazette. Newspapers were a pretty new feature of American life in the 1730s and 40s, spearheaded by printers such as Benjamin Franklin, and soon became important fixtures, a way to share information, connect people together, and advertise local developments. Colonists flocked to copy English tastes, purchase English goods, and indulge in conspicuous consumption, including the newish fads for tea and fine silks. Colonists also consumed political and religious literature, identifying themselves as inheritors of the British constitutional liberties celebrated since the Glorious Revolution and sharing in the glorification of the empire.
British Americans had particular reason to cherish empire, of course, because they were such an ethnic mix themselves, and they were deeply conscious that they were surrounded by other nations' territories, notably the French in Canada, and down the Mississippi in Louisiana, the Spanish in Florida, who remained the largest power in Central and South America. The other European settlements had much smaller populations, but they were strategically positioned, had strong alliances with Native American groups, and a long prehistory of antagonism across colonial boundaries. All in all, then, the world of British America at the start of our period was one of paradoxes, liberty and slavery, expansion and restrictions, agriculture and commerce, autonomy and interdependence went hand in hand. Colonists saw themselves only loosely as Americans, more firmly as Virginians, New Englanders or Pennsylvanians, and still more concretely as British subjects, people sharing in the heritage and future of a prosperous Protestant power that celebrated its mixed constitution, the rights of Englishmen, and its naval and commercial prowess. Philadelphia, Monday, June 11th. I went in the afternoon in the company of some gentlemen to attend the governor of the courthouse stairs, where war was publicly to be proclaimed against France. The procession was led by about 30 flags and ensigns taken from privateer vessels and others in the harbor, which were carried by a parcel of roaring sailors. There was a rabble of about 4,000 people in the street, and great numbers of ladies and gentlemen in the windows and balconies. The governor, with a very audible voice, desired all such persons as were fit to carry arms. "For depend on it," says he, "this province shall not be lost by any neglect or oversight of mine."
How stands the glass around? For shame ye take no care, me boys. How stands the glass around? Let mirth and wine abound.
Welcome to Pod 3, where we are going to examine the impact of external events and British policies on the 13 colonies. Despite being part of the British Empire, London was too far away to rule the colonists with a firm hand, and they existed in a system which historians have labelled salutary neglect, whereby the British oversaw trading matters, but tended to interfere little in domestic politics. The nature of the colonial bond that existed between America and Britain was brought into focus by the financial consequences and the geopolitical results of a number of conflicts that Britain fought in the 18th century.
Colonial America was no stranger to conflict. Skirmishes with Native Americans were fierce and often connected to the larger struggle between Britain and France, who controlled Canada and Louisiana. Spain also had some interest in North America, controlling Florida and what is now Mexico, although there were very few Spaniards in America.
Between 1689 and 1763, the old enemies Britain and France fought in four major conflicts. Some of their fighting even spread to the colonies in the first three of these, although many colonials, preoccupied with settling the frontier, did not really see the conflicts as their business, but more to do with the balance of power in Europe. Britain sought to safeguard the high seas and the wealthy Caribbean with naval forces, but interior protection was often left to colonial militia groups in the War of the Austrian Succession. Citizen armies called up in times of emergency. These militia were not particularly valued by the British, despite such successes as defeating the French and capturing the city of Louisbourg in 1745. A certain sense of anger emerged among the colonists when they felt their hard work was undone at the Peace of Aix-la-Chapelle, when Louisbourg was returned to the French.
There was no sense of finality about this treaty, though, with many believing that Aix-la-Chapelle was just a truce and that conflict would begin again soon. British presence in the colonies was limited to only 500 troops, and the Board of Trade felt that negotiations with Native Americans might help to bolster their strength against the French. A meeting called at Albany in June 1754 failed to secure an alliance with the Iroquois, although warning signs might have been seen by the British when the Congress suggested a scheme for an intercolonial confederation, which envisaged an elected colonial parliament with authority over defence, Native American affairs, and the power to levy an army.
In 1753-54, some Virginia planters organised the Ohio Company and secured 200,000 acres from the British government in a region where the French began to build a series of forts. A force of Virginians led by George Washington set out to stop them, but found the French had taken control of the region already, where they were building Fort Duquesne. The Native Americans spent the next 2 years raiding frontier towns as relations along the frontiers deteriorated, and backcountry settlers were equally vengeful.
In the wake of these engagements, fully-fledged international war, what became the Seven Years' War, was declared in 1756. That it is also known as the French and Indian War in America, where it began, is a telling indication that circumstances were quite different in the old and new worlds. Globally, there was fighting in Europe, West Indies, Africa, India, and America. Initially, the war went badly for Britain and its colonies. The French captured Fort Oswego on Lake Ontario in 1756 and Fort William Henry on Lake George in 1757. This was partly because the British commander, the Earl of Loudoun, couldn't rouse the colonists in defence.
However, once William Pitt became PM in 1757, he turned things around. He wanted to expand Britain's empire and decided America was the key to this. He sent 25,000 troops there under James Wolfe and Geoffrey Amherst. They were given funds to raise 25,000 colonists to help. On arrival, the troops were appalled by the greed of the colonists, being forced to pay for water from wells, paying extreme rents for lodgings, supplies, etc.
Pitt also paid subsidies to Europeans to help in Europe too. His strategy paid off, and in 1758, British forces captured Louisbourg, and then Fort Frontenac, which cut off Canada from the Mississippi, leading to the fall of Fort Duquesne. In India, Robert Clive won a series of victories also. In 1759, further victories were won, with Admiral Hawke smashing the French fleet at Quiberon Bay, which meant reinforcements couldn't be sent to Canada. Britain launched attacks on Canada, with Wolfe capturing Quebec in September. In 1760, Amherst took Montreal, and this destroyed French power there.
At the Peace of Paris in 1763, Britain took Canada and French possessions in America east of the Mississippi, as well as Florida and other Caribbean possessions. Britain was now the greatest imperial power. France now withdrew from Canada and Spain from Florida, but it meant that British government and defence now had to be established over a wider region in case France or Spain attempted to regain lost territory. Britain's debt had doubled, and very different views emerged about what Americans had contributed towards the Redcoats, who had protected their farms against the French in the war, and who now had to also guard Canada. The cost of garrisoning America was put at £300,000 per year.
However, the war trained several men who would become American commanders later, as well as training a large amount of common American troops, many of whom served as rangers, militia, or on privateers. Relationships between British and American troops were somewhat hostile, with Americans typically regarded as rabble, whilst British officers were seen as arrogant by Americans. This had stemmed from the days of press-ganging men into joining the British ships or militia groups, but continued with the apparent arrogance of generals like Braddock, who behaved in a condescending way towards the Americans, like Washington, who had helped in the conflict.
The Americans were also now freed from dependence on British military support against the French. The tie of a common enemy was now gone. From Britain's perspective, it was seen that they had defended the colonists with great bravery. But Americans saw it differently, especially when the British gave land west of the Appalachian Mountains to the Native Americans as a reserve, on which whites could not settle.
Traditionally, the aftermath of the Seven Years' War was identified as an economic depression for the American economy, which sparked off resentment towards the British and perhaps inclined colonists towards independence. However, it is now accepted that the depression was acute but mostly short-lived, and that economic problems over currency and poor relief were more to do with rapid expansion rather than depression. The global struggle with France had been a great success, culminating in the capture of millions of acres in North America. But perhaps unappreciated had been the effect that this enemy on the doorstep had had in reminding Britons and colonists of their mutual dependence. With France removed, new questions soon presented themselves about imperial governance, and they would be answered with fresh memories of the conflicts and the considerable sacrifices made by both the mother country and the colonial population. Welcome to Pod 4, where we are going to examine the impact of British policy on the colonies between 1763 and 1770. Until this point, Britain had coexisted in a state of salutary neglect, but the impact of the Seven Years' War had altered that equilibrium. Soldiers had returned home with tales of American wealth and a higher standard of living, and politicians, anxious to balance the books following an expensive series of conflicts, looked towards the colonies to pay their way. The colonists, though, had other ideas. They saw no need for a British standing army now that the French threat had been removed from their shores, especially one that treated colonial troops with disdain and sought quartering in their private residences. This conflict was exacerbated by a series of decisions made in London, which triggered a robust response from an emerging radical political consciousness, centred largely in Massachusetts.
Britain's relationship with the colonies had always been rather distant, and in 1763 most colonists were eager for this to continue. However, Britain's finances had been stretched, and its growing national debt stood at over £120 million following their global conflicts during the Seven Years' War. Notwithstanding this amount, the interest payments alone were over £5 million per year, according to Thomas Purvis, an amount that grabbed the attention of the King and his ministers throughout the period. The Prime Minister in 1763, George Grenville, saw a need for stronger control of the empire, not only to help to alleviate the national debt, but also because the acquisition of French Canada now left a huge area to govern and protect.
His solution of a 10,000-strong standing army in the colonies needed financing. Tales of a higher standard of living in America had been circulating in London following the return of those who had fought in the French Indian Wars, and this, alongside the need to reduce the national debt, encouraged Grenville to increase taxation there. Certainly, British people paid far more tax than their colonial counterparts, and Grenville thought it was prudent to ask for a contribution to what he saw as a necessary part of colonial defence. This was confirmed when a rebellion of Native American tribes in the Ohio Valley saw the capture and destruction of several British forts before the army quashed it in 1764.
However, it was a territorial decision as much as a question of taxation that aroused colonial passions. Grenville sought better relations with the Native American tribes, and alongside removing trade restrictions, he passed a Proclamation Act in 1763, which set the Appalachian Mountains as the boundary for white colonial settlement. Many colonists were angry at this interference in their domestic affairs, and the line was largely ignored by frontiersmen and companies who sought to exploit the rich resources of the region beyond the disputed boundary.
Grenville sought to raise income by tightening up on American evasion of the trade laws. The Customs Board estimated that the average revenue from American customs was only £1,800, whilst the cost of maintaining a standing army was likely to exceed £300,000. Smuggling was to be tackled by a controversial new court situated in Nova Scotia. This would ensure that the judges would not be pressured by local views, nor would their decisions be encumbered by the deliberations of a jury. This directly interfered with legal practices in the colonies and raised much protest. Further reforms of the Sugar Act and the Currency Act did little to alleviate the growing concern that Britain was veering from the position of salutary neglect that had been their modus operandi for so long. However, despite the hostility towards the Sugar Act, it was rather localized to three colonies. Massachusetts, Rhode Island, and Connecticut, where most distilleries were situated.
Matters came to a head with the proposal of a Stamp Act in 1764 that was due to come into effect in 1765. Because the stamps were levied on the spot, this enlarged the debate beyond that of raising revenue and brought into question the issue of Parliament's sovereignty over the colonies. Unlike the protests against the Sugar Act, the idea that there would be a universal stamp tax aroused much stronger feelings, with William Smith commenting that this single stroke has lost Great Britain the affection of all her colonies.
Smith's point was proven by Patrick Henry's impassioned speech in Virginia's lower house, where a number of resolutions against the Stamp Act were carried, but particularly the key idea that there should be no taxation without representation in the British Parliament. His ideas did not go unopposed, though, with some expunged the day after being carried for fear of being too provocative. However, the Virginia resolves caught American imagination, and eight other colonies followed suit, with challenging messages to London. A Stamp Act Congress was held in October 1764 as a result of these strong feelings, and this set out their beliefs about the colonial relationship with Britain. They acknowledged their allegiance to the Crown, but restated that without representation in Parliament, the only lawful bodies that could tax them were colonial assemblies.
Resistance to the Stamp Act started in Boston, with a group known as the Loyal Nine, later to become the Sons of Liberty. An effigy of the local stamp distributor was hung from a tree, and his house was ransacked, prompting him to resign. Without such officials, the tax could not be collected. The violence spread to other colonies, where other officials also resigned rather than face the trouble. The repeal of the Stamp Act followed when merchants threatened to stop ordering British goods, which coincided with a change in ministry in London. Colonists expressed their delight by constructing liberty poles and championing successful opponents of the legislation. These symbols of resistance and new groups were important rallying points that offered a new kind of political expression.
Despite the repeal of the Stamp Act, politicians in London continued to devise new schemes for taxing the colonies, emphasising Parliament's right to do so. The Chancellor after 1766, Charles Townshend, drew up a subtler plan to target duties on items that colonists would find hard to evade, like paper and glass. He hoped such taxes would yield a reasonable return for the Crown. In addition, to tackle the issue of supplying units barracked in the colonies, he enforced the Quartering Act of 1765, which enabled troops to be lodged at the expense of the colonists. When New York refused to comply, the New York Restraining Act suspended their assembly until they did. The colonists soon resorted to their earlier methods of resistance, hardening their opposition to taxation and reviving the Sons of Liberty movement, as well as organizing merchant boycotts that spread to many colonies by 1769. Officials were attacked, as were merchants who attempted to evade this action.
The boycott had the desired effect. A and by 1770 Lord North had repealed all taxes except those on tea. Antagonism, though, continued. The presence of British troops in Boston did nothing to improve relations between London and the colonies. In February 1770, a young boy had been killed by a British official during a riot. Simmering hostility finally erupted into violence in March, when a crowd threatening British troops were fired upon. Labelled the Boston Massacre by radical propagandists, the episode saw the first casualties of the imperial crisis, with 5 deaths. The resulting trial saw the acquittal of all but 2 troops, whose defence was overseen by John Adams. Their sanction, after pleading benefit of clergy, was thumb-branding followed by release. The deterioration in relations between Britain and her colonies was not helped by this.
The key to this pod is to examine the impact of British legislation on the colonies. Its impact was as much psychological as physical. The colonists had existed under a system that allowed them much self-government until 1763, but now felt that London was beginning to interfere in affairs that they saw as their own. Taxation was certainly a key issue, but equally political decisions, such as the cap on expansion, which the 1763 proclamation outlined, was an unacceptable change in direction from the British government. British heavy-handedness in suspending assemblies and in sending in troops into Boston in 1768 caused anger and encouraged a revolutionary spirit among groups, such as the Sons of Liberty. However, their response to such actions, in repealing the Townshend duties and not enforcing martial law in Boston, encouraged the colonists to pursue a rigorous defence of their right to rule themselves.
In the last pod, we explored how British policy in the 1760s provoked American responses, and how colonists began to mobilise and coordinate their actions. But it's one thing to riot or protest in the face of impositions, and another thing to justify those riots and explain those protests. In this fifth pod, we turn to the intellectual arguments that Americans made when they thought about not just what they were doing, but why they were doing it. What historians have found when they explore these root ideologies or systems of belief is that colonists started off in some ways as being backward-looking. But as the imperial crisis developed, they became increasingly innovative and bold with the ideas they drew from and linked together. The protests in America acted as a nursery for radical thinking, as colonists found themselves led by their own sense of British identity to challenge far more than just particular taxes. Eventually, they would come to unpick the whole fabric of constitutional power on which the empire depended.
At the start of the 1760s, the building blocks of colonial intellectual culture were similar to those back in the mother country, and we might think of them as Anglo-American, derived from the heritage of English constitutionalism. In particular, as historian Bernard Bailyn argued in an important work titled The Ideological Origins of the American Revolution, colonists harked back to the Glorious Revolution in 1689, where men like John Lougheed justified the overthrow of James II by emphasizing that free men had innate natural rights, and that the best form of protection of these rights lay in a balance of government that gave prime place to elected representatives. Parliament had emerged as the key guardian of these rights, and there was wide recognition that part of the genius of the British Constitution was its empowering of representatives to be watchful of any threat to Englishmen's lives, liberties, and property. a whole discourse developed over the course of the early 18th century that placed great cultural value on classical republican tenets. Ideas such as our right to trial by jury, our right not to have our property disposed of against our will, the dangers of a standing army, and so on. These so-called English liberties tended to be contrasted with the absolutism that could be found in other nations, and were often invoked when challenging the undue influence of particular court favourites of this period.
An important feature of this political identity was the growing impact of print culture. The way that texts, pamphlets, magazines, newspapers and books increased in circulation and reach over the course of the 18th century. In the Age of Enlightenment, readers were able to access and digest a huge range of ideas and writings, and even foreign texts were quickly translated, read, and adopted into the public sphere. Whereas some authorities tried to censor or limit the transmission of radical ideas and new philosophies, the American print landscape was remarkably open, literate, dynamic, and responsive. New newspapers, libraries, gentlemen's clubs and coffee houses were being set up all the time, particularly in the cities. All of this meant that not only did Americans understand a common ideological heritage connected to English liberties, but they had access to ready means to build on this and introduce new aspects.
The political philosophy of colonial resistance tended to be first articulated by the literate elites. And it's not a coincidence that American lawyers, merchants, printers, and planters were among the first to be energized by the proposed British taxes on stamps or paper. Initially, the arguments were somewhat hesitant and paradoxical, as when James Otis of Massachusetts explained in 1764 in The Rights of the British Colonies asserted and proved that Americans unquestionably owed obedience to Parliament, but that it was possible for ministers to accidentally infringe on colonists' natural rights, in which case they needed to be told. On some levels, such contributions were far from radical, and in no sense did they demonstrate a fledgling desire for independence, usually emphasizing loyalty to the king and to the British constitution, but they did express ideas that would assume increasingly radical overtones as the crisis deepened, including the argument that Parliament was incapable of legislating the needs of subjects 3,000 miles away, and that internal taxation, such as the Stamp Act, without representation, amounted to a disenfranchisement of an American's civil rights.
Over the course of the later 1760s, the language of liberty became more infectious, and American writers retreated to clearer ideas, resolving some of the paradoxes and divisions that had been apparent. John Dickinson, a Pennsylvanian, was one such theorist who swept away a series of claims and challenged the legitimacy of the Quartering Act and Townshend Acts. Where others had argued about the murky lines between what was an internal tax versus an external tax, or whether Americans enjoyed virtual representation in Parliament, in his Letters from a Farmer, Dickinson explained in clear, common, direct language that all such impositions amounted to the same thing: an unfair and unconstitutional burden that it was not only possible but necessary to resist. As a consequence of bundling together long-standing fears about standing armies, legal justice, taxation, and arbitrary power, Americans rallied behind a new understanding of how the empire should function. By the early 1770s, many viewed Parliament as having little jurisdiction over colonial affairs at all. A body that had lost its way, driven awry by a set of grasping ministers who had failed to appreciate the larger picture.
Some in England were actually sympathetic to this portrayal, and to the American colonists' frustrations. Radicals such as John Wilkes criticised the establishment, espousing a more republican approach for British politics. Others, such as Edmund Burke, called for a more pragmatic colonial approach. For Parliament to repeatedly provoke the colonies, he felt, was completely counterproductive. far better to accept a loose relationship and to rely upon cultural solidarity and commercial self-interest in the long term than to keep fighting and losing on small political points.
In other circumstances, we might imagine some of this ideological debate remaining at a rather intellectual level, a matter for politicians and lawyers. But thanks to the wide mobilisation of colonists in crowds, committees and congresses, and the many paths by which ideas could reach ordinary people, from tavern songs to newspaper adverts, church meetings to cartoons, notions quickly gathered momentum. One of the ironies of the developing position was that Americans insisted that it was they who clung on to the original version of English liberties, their birthright, and it was the mother country that had gone astray. Another irony of defending not just tax levels but liberty and natural rights was that these ideas, if fully unleashed, threatened to challenge the social fabric within many colonies. How much radicalism, worried men like Dickinson and John Adams, should be permissible? What about the representation, or for that matter the natural rights, of slaves, servants, labourers, women, or any other disadvantaged group, many of whom were making major contributions to the protest movements? Dickinson therefore cautioned his countrymen. Be upon your guard against those who may at any time endeavour to stir you up, under pretences of patriotism, to any measures disrespectful to our sovereign and our mother country. But in the years that followed, the space for moderation and cool heads seemed to be shrinking, and new writers would take Republican ideology to new levels.
On June 9, 1772, a British ship, the HMS Gaspee, ran aground off the coast of Rhode Island. It had been engaged in anti-smuggling operations. A small band of men from the Sons of Liberty, including Abraham Whipple and John Brown, sailed out to the ship and boarded it. There, they attacked the crew and shot Lieutenant William Duddingston, before looting and torching the ship. A Royal Commission of Inquiry called for those responsible to be sent to Britain to be tried with treason, alarming people to such an extent that committees of correspondence were formed throughout the colonies, whilst in Virginia, an intercolonial committee was formed to discuss the matter jointly with those other committees.
Welcome to Pod 6, where we're going to examine the growing political consciousness of the colonies and their reaction to yet more interference from Britain. The last pod examined how the colonists justified their responses with intellectual and philosophical arguments, recalling the very same arguments used during the Glorious Revolution when James II was overthrown. However, despite the increasing divide, there was still much soul-searching to be conducted by many colonists who continued to value their British links and were in no way looking for independence. However, the mistakes being made by politicians in London made it difficult for them to retain that loyalty in the face of a more radical stream of political discourse developing in America.
It was that most British of customs, drinking tea, that was to stir colonial passions once more in 1773. Lord North had abolished almost all of Townshend's duties in 1770, except those on tea. A more accommodationist approach by the new Secretary for the Colonies, the Earl of Dartmouth, had ushered in a period of relatively peaceful relations. Colonial grievances found a new outlet through the creation of committees of correspondence, with the first set up in Boston, but soon spreading to other colonies. These fostered some sense of colonial cooperation, although they continued to be divided over land boundaries and commercial interests.
It is ironic that the tea crisis began with the British actually reducing the price of tea in the colonies. Since the Townsend duties had been implemented, an American boycott on tea had left warehouses packed with this commodity. The East India Company was in financial difficulty, although not all of its troubles could be blamed on the American boycott, with its finances also stretched by generous dividends and the lavish lifestyles of its executive body. Lord North knew that the financial collapse of such a significant company would spell a disaster for the British economy. In searching for a solution to help this important business, he avoided the simplest solution, abolishing the 3 pence colonial tax placed on tea. In doing so, he was restating his steadfast belief that Parliament had the right to levy taxes in the colonies.
North's eventual solution was to offer a tax rebate to merchants who exported tea to America from Britain, whilst also allowing the company to sell tea directly through its own merchants in America, rather than sell their commodity at public auction. This angered not only those who pointed out that the British were trying to trick them into accepting another tax, but also merchants who saw a monopoly being created, which might extend to other commodities in the future.
Whilst ships were making their way to the colonies with vast quantities of tea, the American press was in full cry against the machinations of the British government. British politicians were blissfully unaware of the problems this legislation would cause, believing that the reduction in price would be welcomed by colonists. This was despite Benjamin Franklin's warning that the politicians had no idea that people might act out of principle rather than accept an economically beneficial policy.
When the ships eventually arrived in Philadelphia, Charleston, New York, and Boston, the East India Company found resistance was strong. None of their cargo was sold, either refused at source or being stored in warehouses without any prospect of being sold. In Boston, though, the role of Governor Hutchinson complicated things as he refused to sanction the ships being sent back to Britain without being unloaded and the correct tax paid. After weeks of wrangling, a few radicals boarded the Dartmouth and two other ships, the Eleanor and the Beaver, dressed as Amerindians, and smashed the tea chests before dumping the cargo overboard. About £10,000 worth of tea was destroyed, although the ships themselves were untouched.
The Boston Tea Party was a direct attack on British sovereignty in Lord North's eyes, and the response of the British government was to attack the sovereignty of the government of Boston. The other colonies had not adopted such an extreme position, despite refusing the British tea. The British government summoned Franklin to a public dressing down in Whitehall, despite being someone who had expressed his disapproval of the Tea Party, and then, in an attempt to restore parliamentary control, four coercive, or intolerable acts, as the colonists named them, saw the British imposing their will on the people of Boston.
The acts closed the port of Boston to further trade, until the time when the tea had been paid for and the king had decided that shipping was safe there again. Perhaps more significantly, the Massachusetts Government Bill would allow the king to choose the upper house and bring local government under control of the governor, limiting the democracy of the region. Two further acts undermined the judicial procedures of New England by allowing the governor to transfer cases of government officials to other colonies or even to England if he felt a fair local trial was impossible because of vindictive juries. Finally, the Quartering Act was designed to close the festering wounds left open since the Seven Years' War, by allowing the commander of the British Army to override the inferior quartering offered by the colony by taking over unoccupied buildings as he saw fit. In addition to these acts, the Quebec Act, passed at this time, saw the Catholic Church allowed to establish itself in the newly acquired colony. There, a non-elected government was created and given claims to land that people in the 13 colonies felt they had claims to as well. However, one thing that should be made clear is that the British government aimed these acts at Massachusetts alone. They were not a direct attack on other colonies although the radicals of Boston were at pains to suggest they were.
How did the colonies respond to these acts? In fact, not all colonists had agreed with the actions of the radicals who took part in the Tea Party, but the reaction of the British government solidified their response. The calls for an economic boycott of British goods grew louder, and many colonies gradually succumbed. By the summer of 1774, all colonies except Georgia had arranged for delegates to attend the First Continental Congress in Philadelphia.
The meeting found it difficult to agree on much. Divisions between conservatives and radicals were evident, and as such, there was no agreement on a list of colonial rights or on Parliament's right to regulate American trade. There was some unanimity on a trade embargo with Britain, and through the Continental Association, it persuaded colonies to establish committees of inspection to carry out an economic boycott and enforce the order. These were set up throughout the colonies, with more enthusiasm in New England than anywhere else. These committees gave positions of responsibility to increasing numbers of colonists, who had little connection with those who dominated the old provincial congresses.
The divisions of the First Continental Congress had largely disappeared by the time of the Second Continental Congress in May 1775. This national body, together with the committees of correspondence and the committees of inspection, were an alternative source of power. The actions of the British Army in Boston had hardened the resolve of the colonists to meet force with force, even if they disagreed on what future they were fighting for.
We didn't always get along, but over the centuries, what eventually bound us together, what made us all Americans, was not a matter of blood, it wasn't a matter of birth. It was faith and fidelity to the shared values that we all hold so dear. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. Endowed with certain inalienable rights, life and liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That's what makes us unique. That's what makes us strong.
The Declaration of Independence, mainly drafted by Thomas Jefferson of Virginia, has provided us with some of the most iconic and inspirational words in modern history. Repeatedly, its language of self-evident truths, of being created equal, and of people holding unalienable rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, has been invoked in lofty rhetoric. The Declaration has been echoed in great events in history, including the French Revolution in 1789, and the first Women's Rights Convention at Seneca Falls, New York, in 1848. 100 years later, Ho Chi Minh drew directly on what he called this immortal statement when he sought to establish a constitutional footing for the people of the Democratic Republic of Vietnam.
In this podcast, we explore how the Second Continental Congress and the Americans it represented moved from a position of reacting to British impositions to one of constructing a new republican nation. The period between 1775 and 1776 witnessed a seismic shift in many, though not all, Americans' viewpoints, as most came to the conclusion that the only path forward was to break with the British Empire and the British identity that they had so relished, and to declare their independence and set up new governments. Half-united colonies, at a stroke in July 1776, would become the United States. But this was not a decision that was easily reached or self-evident. It committed Americans to a bloody and protracted war against the foremost world superpower. Congress felt able to take such a momentous step because it was riding the crest of a wave of popular energy. This was partly an energy that derived from anger and fear because of the measures of the king, his military forces, and his colonial officers. Most of the Declaration of Independence is a long list of grievances about tyrannical abuses. But we remember those sections little today. More appealing across the generations has been the positive energy expressed out of belief and hope in America's capacity to thrive as an independent nation. These positive ideas were harnessed and expressed by key propagandists such as Thomas Paine and constitutional writers such as Jefferson and John Adams, who married together political ideology with the practicalities of American situation in 1776.
Almost exactly a year before the Declaration of Independence, in the summer of 1775, when localized hostilities had already erupted around Boston and the colonial boycotts and protests were in full swing, the Continental Congress issued two documents that help us track how far their position would move over the next 12 months.
The first of these was a declaration of the causes and necessities of taking up arms, which offered a kind of history lesson and self-justification, explaining why colonists were now arming and defending themselves. It laid the blame, above all, on Parliament for being cruel and impolitic. But the Declaration took every opportunity to insist that independence was not an ambition or a motivation for Congress. As they put it, "The indignation of the Americans was roused, it is true, but it was the indignation of a virtuous, loyal, and affectionate people." They insisted that, "We have not raised armies with ambitious designs of separation from Great Britain and establishing independent states."
2 days later, on July 8, 1775, a more direct document was also drawn up, which came to be known as the Olive Branch Petition, and was dispatched direct to the King. It arrived in London at the same time as news that at Bunker Hill, the colonists had gunned down some 81 officers and inflicted over 1,000 casualties on British forces, evicting them from high ground outside Boston. So the king refused to hear it on the throne.
Some historians have argued that this petition was not authentic, and that its real purpose was to help convince conservative Americans that they had done everything they could and were approaching the issue of independence as a genuine last resort. But whether disingenuous or not, there could be little doubting the hardening of the king's view and of the measures that he approved on behalf of Lord North's ministry.
In the 9 months between September 1775 and June 1776, a combination of push and pull factors would nudge just enough Americans into embracing the idea of independence to pressurize Congress to declare the birth of a new nation. The push factors were measures beyond the control of Congress, both in Britain and by British officials in America, that made it clear that no reconciliation was likely to occur.
Instead, the news stung. The king, in whom they had hoped for support to tame Parliament, retorted with proclamations of rebellion and angry measures. He approved the hiring of Hessian mercenaries from the German states, signed the Prohibitory Act, which threatened American shipping and sanctioned the bombarding of several seaports across the colonies. His Virginian governor, Lord Dunmore, issued a proclamation from the safety of a British Navy warship in November 1775 that sent shockwaves through the South, offering freedom to slaves and indentured servants who abandoned their patriot masters and served in his Ethiopian regiment. Nothing could be more traumatic or disruptive to the planter elite.
Faced with economic and political turmoil, the extension of the conflict, and the seeming deafness of the king, Americans began to embrace self-government as the only tolerable way forward. In January 1776, they found a remarkable spokesperson who seemed to capture and drive forward their views. Thomas Paine had only recently arrived in the colonies, an immigrant of radical egalitarian beliefs who thrived in the politically effervescent city of Philadelphia, but by the end of the year, everyone knew his name.
Paine wrote a short pamphlet called Common Sense that appealed to Americans' hopes, their fears, their realities and their possibilities, and that urged them to embrace independence, pitching it in everyday language that ordinary farmers, townsfolk, and sailors could relate to when discussed in taverns and coffee houses. Paine cut through the last ties of loyalty to Britain. He demonstrated that kingship was flawed and unfair, that the House of Lords and aristocracy was bogus, and that the only solution to the current crisis was revolution.
Paine's wonderful prose was not all negative, outlining a vision of America that was great, rich, expansive, and self-confident. Despite the grumbling of John Adams, who felt it was lightweight, it swept across the colonies as printing presses struggled to keep up with demand.
It was John Adams himself who called on all colonies to adopt new constitutions and construct their own blueprints for miniature republics, given that Britain had forsaken them. These processes were just as important as Paine's arguments in generating a new sense of identity. More and more endorsements of the idea of independence dripped through from parishes, townships, counties and colonies, putting pressure on the Continental Congress to act.
By June, there was enough momentum to move Congress forward. And in response to Richard Lee's motion on independence, a committee was assembled, spearheaded by Thomas Jefferson, to draft a form of words to sever the connection between the old world and the new. The task was to distill down the 13 years of American grievances and frame them in a Republican ideology and libertarian sentiment. They needed to produce a document capable of rallying the anxious Continental Army to the glorious cause in the face of the expected arrival of 32,000 British soldiers, and perhaps most importantly, to attract the attention and sympathy of an international audience.
The Declaration was a profoundly modern statement, and yet full of contradictions and downright hypocrisy. The language of liberty expressed by slave owners, the limits of its equality, white and male, at least as evident as its extent.
Perhaps the best way to see the Declaration in relation to the American Revolution is as a reluctant tool, like a pair of scissors, sharpened by British abuses on the one hand and American stridency on the other. It emerged as the only way to resolve the breakdown in social order. Using it opened up a world of possibilities that were exciting and frightening in equal measure. The unfortunate and untimely defeat at Trenton has thrown us further back than was first apprehended, from the great encouragement it has given to the rebels. I do not now see a prospect of terminating the war, but by a general action, and I am aware of the difficulties in our way to obtain it, as the enemy moves with much more celerity than we possibly can.
So wrote deflated British General Sir William Howe in December 1776. Under his direction, the campaigning in the summer and autumn had progressed well for the King. The British had assembled and mobilised an unprecedentedly large invasion force of over 30,000 men, most of them hardy and experienced troops from the British Isles and hired soldiers from the German principalities. Led by veteran officers, they had cautiously but effectively driven American forces from New York and occupied that critical port at the heart of the eastern seaboard.
Welcome to Part 8, where we will examine the key military developments in the Revolutionary War and explore the reasons for the British loss. This pod puts the British war effort particularly under the microscope, explaining the challenges that limited how effective generals such as Howe could be, and why the manifest military superiority of the mother country seemed not to bite as much as it could, or perhaps should have. We'll look at the quality of the leadership, the difficulties of communication and consolidation, and the way that advantages could also quickly become disadvantages in the vast interior of North America. By the end, you should have a good sense of why Britain struggled to win the war.
In the past, historians liked to poke fun at the British commanders, a task made easier because when things started going wrong, many of them took to the newspapers and parliamentary committees to blame one another.
I have been forced into a bad post by my orders, and had been induced to remain there contrary to my judgment. Charles Cornwallis. The minister directed me to support Lord Cornwallis and solid operation in Virginia, the danger of which, without a covering fleet, I had constantly represented to him. He repeatedly and positively promised me a covering fleet. Henry Clinton.
But while the easiest explanation might be to say that Britain squandered its advantages because of aristocratic generals making blunder after blunder on the battlefield, this isn't really a fair or an accurate viewpoint. For the most part, the British generals were highly qualified and well-resourced, especially during the first half of the war. They had proved themselves in the past, and many would go on to in future imperial campaigns. The problem that they faced was that the American war was unlike any other.
American resistance could be stubborn, and the new Continental Army had shown at Bunker Hill in June 1775 that they could inflict casualties on the Redcoats, a point at which many British politicians finally accepted that there was a serious rebellion in motion, and that a major war effort needed hastily planning. But actually, in most open engagements throughout the war, British superiority told on the battlefield. Professionalism, discipline, coordination, and experience was supported by the Royal Navy's dominant presence. And behind all of it lay the financial and manufacturing strength of the British state that the Americans were unable to match.
Yet, even at the high watermark of British successes in 1776 and 1777, problems were apparent that connected not so much to the fighting, but to the thinking behind the war. Perhaps the biggest difficulty was how to match up the presence of an occupying army and its repressive military activity with Britain's ultimate aim of bringing the colonies back to submission and finding a peaceful, stable, political reconciliation. William Howe and his brother Admiral Richard Howe had been given the roles not just of military commanders, but also of peace commissioners. But these two functions sat uneasily. They were not empowered to recognize the fact of American independence, so discussions with congressional representatives were brusque and pointless. And every town and region the British occupied tended to splinter opinion, meaning many colonists who had not held strong feelings, and might have entertained a moderate position, were driven either to the Patriot side or into becoming reluctant loyalists.
When British forces offered to recruit, sometimes to free, slaves and servants out of military necessity, they offended American slaveholders. When they occupied territory, they upset American farmers. And all the more so when, as often happened, foreign soldiers misbehaved, consuming, looting, and ravishing. Military occupation, in short, even built on successful campaigns and the reduction of cities like Boston, New York, Philadelphia, Savannah, and Charleston, which were all captured at some point in the war, could not win back hearts and minds.
Linked to this dilemma was the question of strategy. Howe and his fellow generals yearned for the chance, as he put it, to terminate the war. But how were they to achieve this? There seemed to be no center to strike at that would produce a decisive effect. Washington and his Continentals retreated. Congress and state militias dispersed. port cities needed garrisoning and defending, which diluted troop strength. And the American interior was vast, a nightmare of forests, rivers, hills, and thinly spread settlements running from Canada to Florida. This stretched out communication and supply lines and created a huge amount of uncertainty about the nature and whereabouts of one's allies, let alone one's enemies.
The British war effort was led by Lord North and directed by Lord George Germain, the Secretary of State responsible for provisioning, coordinating, and issuing instructions to the British commanders. Their initial goal was to contain the rebellion to Massachusetts, hoping that one or two decisive victories over the most vociferous rebels would be decisive in crushing revolutionary fervor. Silencing New England might prompt a rollback of political dissent across America. But this betrayed a misperception of how widely revolutionary sentiment had spread. Targets were subsequently adjusted, leaving Boston to strike at the middle colonies, where Germain hoped to nullify Washington or Congress and thereby deny the revolutionary movement its lifeblood and credibility.
The gulf between London-hatched plans and their implementation in America turned into disaster in 1777. As different versions of proposals, plans, and promises crisscrossed the Atlantic, two major operations proceeded in different directions. William Howe withdrew from New Jersey and sailed south to seize Philadelphia, the seat of Congress, narrowly missing out on a full frontal engagement with Washington's main army, but inflicting heavy casualties and causing huge consternation to the Patriots. Meanwhile, a separate 8,000-man army under John Burgoyne set out from Quebec, Canada, in an effort to take Albany and join up with British forces in New York, thereby controlling the Hudson River Valley. But while the confident Burgoyne was a notorious gambler and had sought out a chance to shine, this incursion was a risk too far. Slowed by the impenetrable terrain, picked off by clusters of Patriot militia, deserted by Indian allies, and, by the autumn, bereft of supplies, information, and reinforcements, Burgoyne eventually surrendered his 5,000-strong force to Horatio Gates at Saratoga on the 7th of October, 1777.
Strategic confusion, communication problems, and the American environment kept hampering the British war effort. But after Saratoga, the nature and scale of the conflict changed dramatically. The Patriot cause at a point of collapse was reinvigorated by the news, and most importantly, Saratoga convinced other major European powers to lend their support openly to the American rebels.
From 1778, with the Dutch, Spanish, and especially the French now fully mobilized in what was becoming a global conflict, British ambitions and commitments in America had to be substantially downsized. Trying to subdue the rebellion in places it was strong had failed, so the British now concentrated on areas it was perceived to be weak and launched a so-called Southern Strategy that would see momentum built from areas in the South that were more loyal and more accessible, as well as being nearer to Britain's critical but vulnerable holdings in the Caribbean.
With the cautious Henry Clinton holding on to New York and other bases in the north, Charles Cornwallis led an invasion that swept up from Georgia and the Carolinas in 1779-80, and initially seemed to be going well. The problem of occupation and pacification, though, again reared its head. Expectations that people would return to the king's banner and that the hordes of loyalists would be willing to fight outside their own settlements proved ill-founded. Territory was only ever temporarily controlled, and once numbers of British troops moved on, Patriot forces re-emerged like the magic candles that are snuffed out but then reignite.
They often brought vicious civil wars and destruction in their wake, and at times the American War, as in New Jersey and the southern backcountry, became brutal and disfiguring. A war of terror in the shadows of the rival armies and naval forces, in which fugitive slaves and families sought safety, and renegade bands and pirates preyed.
Deprived of a relief fleet or reinforcements, and again owing to poor communications, poor weather, and overstretch, Cornwallis and his disease-ridden army found themselves trapped on a narrow peninsula in Virginia in September 1781. Lord North had already tried to resign on several occasions, but upon discovery from Germain of the surrender at Yorktown of the last mobile British army and the failure of the southern strategy, he cried, "Oh God, it is all over."
In spite of the king's desire to continue the war, political will in Britain had collapsed, and the writing was on the wall. British and loyalist forces clung on to remaining ports and outposts, but offensive operations were abandoned, and peace negotiations, this time including acceptance of American independence, reluctantly begun.
The British war effort was therefore characterized by strategic indecision, poor communications, and at times, weak leadership. However, here we have only focused on the British war effort, and so in the next pod, we will turn our attention to the way that the Americans fought this campaign, to understand why it was they, rather than the British, who were able to emerge from this conflict victorious. These are the times that try men's souls. The summer soldier and the sunshine patriot will, in this crisis, shrink from the service of their country. But he that stands it now deserves the love and thanks of man and woman. Tyranny, like hell, is not easily conquered. Yet we have this consolation with us, that the harder the conflict, the more glorious the triumph.
So wrote Thomas Paine in a series of essays designed to shore up American morale in the face of overwhelming odds in December 1776. The pamphlets were designed to be inspirational and intended to be read by the flagging soldiers of the Continental Army, by worried citizen soldiers organized into local militia units, and by concerned citizens, farmers, and tradespeople all across the colonies. They were fittingly called the Crisis.
In this pod, we round off the consideration of the War of Independence that we began in Pod 8. This time, thinking especially about the Americans' affairs and the American experience of conflict. British weaknesses would have counted for nothing had there not been soldiers and patriots serving their fledgling country both in the sunshine and during the bitter winters, and ready to capitalize on errors and miscalculations in key battles such as Saratoga and Yorktown.
We'll concentrate on three strengths which the Americans were able to press home as the war unfolded. Firstly, the leadership and respect for George Washington as a link between the battlefield and the political theatre. Secondly, the innovative use of tactics and forces that compromised how effective the superior British troops could be. And thirdly, the role of foreign forces in provisioning, supporting, and supplementing tired and bedraggled farmer soldiers as the war ground on. Lastly, we'll consider the upshot of all these factors in the Peace of Paris in 1783 that finally marked the end of the war and allowed the British and 13 of their American colonies to part ways with finality.
When the Second Continental Congress frantically sought to impose some order upon the assortment of angry colonists who were forming around Boston in 1775, there was little doubt as to who they would select to act as commander-in-chief of the American forces. George Washington, a Virginian planter with a large estate at Mount Vernon, was among the most experienced and respected American military officers in the colonies, and had turned up in his full uniform. An imposing man, tall, stoic, and quietly ambitious, and obsessed about his profile, he may not have been the most talented battlefield general, but he proved to be an inspirational choice because of his leadership qualities, his inspirational status, and his capacity to learn from mistakes and to adapt to straitened circumstances.
As we learned in the past pod, the basic structure of the major engagements in the American Revolutionary War was that, following British strategy, they were rooted in New England in 1775 to 1776, then hovered around the Middle Colonies in 1776 to 1778, before dominating the South in 1779, until Cornwallis's capitulation at Yorktown in 1781. And that shift of main operations to the Southern theatre coincided with a much larger globalisation of the war that dramatically altered the equation for Britain. Throughout the war, the British and Hessian professionals held firm in the face of continental and militia pressure, but were rarely in a situation where they could effectively press an advantage.
While some of that owed to British difficulties and failings, much credit must go to Washington and his generals for managing to both evade destruction and sustain pressure on the British-held lines and territory. Let's not forget that though it was called a Continental Army, Congress's forces were actually a ramshackle assortment of regional yeomen, urban labourers, young recruits, and seasonal fighters. Libertarian ideology may have been a useful recruiting aid alongside the motivation of defending their homes and families, especially early on, or when enthusiasm was high. But these lost purchase as the war dragged on, became ugly, or as supplies dwindled and armies moved to other zones. Only thanks to some remarkable improvisational organization by committees, aide-de-camp, and local elites could patriots just about mobilize enough soldiers to defend key lines or seize episodic opportunities.
In the process, the war for the Americans came to be more than just a military trial. It was a way of putting to the test the very ideas connected to independence and republicanism themselves. The Continental Army and the state militia were not just where Americans tested their might against nasty Hessians, but were a testing ground for ideas about political culture, about authority, about localism, and about the economy and finances. Wartime experiences would have a bearing on the era that followed, turning revolutionary republicanism into much more than something theoretical. In numerous acts of self-sacrifice, soldiers and other combatants, and many civilians who invested in currency, paid for goods or furnished materials, created a stake in the war, and therefore in the nation that followed.
The war taught patriots that they would need to moderate their high-minded ideals with self-interest and survival. You couldn't elect every officer. You couldn't rely on volunteers or open enlistments. You couldn't count on requisitions or patriotism alone. In spite of consistent defeats and setbacks, Americans adapted irregular tactics, refined and trained frontline troops, and found appropriate units and leaders to accomplish local needs, such as the guerrilla fighters who frustrated British and Loyalists in the forests and swamps of the Lower South, or the eclectic naval forces who disrupted convoys and communications.
In some ways, George Washington's accomplishments, seen in this light, were not so much to do with battlefield manoeuvring, but his managing to sustain a loosely connected army out of the limited service most freedom-focused Americans were willing to undertake. When criticized for the army's decline in their winter quarters at Valley Forge in 1777, where starvation, exposure, disease, and malnutrition killed nearly 2,500 American soldiers and some 700 horses, Washington was quick to point out that it was easy for politicians to criticize from their positions of safety.
But for all the provocations and temptations, because we have to remember, offers, spies, mutineers, and deserters plagued both British and American lines, Washington's integrity and commitment to being a servant of Congress and the glorious cause remained impeccable. Famously, at the end of the war, he returned his commission and went back to Mount Vernon, already glorified in versions of Yankee Doodle, a popular war song on both sides, albeit with very different lyrics.
Washington was one of a handful of Americans known by people in Europe. His continued presence gave the revolution credibility. Even greater was the international profile of scientist and statesman Benjamin Franklin, who departed for Paris in the same month that Thomas Paine began the crisis. Once installed, Franklin masterminded a network of operations and social and political connections that gave the American war profile and influence. Even before France's full and open participation, Franklin was secretly securing munitions and finance, even before their alliance in 1778.
The irony that the great traditional enemy of British Americans was now riding to their rescue was not lost on observers on either side of the Atlantic. The French saw an opportunity to recapture ground lost in the Seven Years' War, whilst weakening the British hold in Europe, India, Africa, and the West Indies. Alongside French credit, muskets and cannons that flowed to the desperate Americans, foreign involvement extended to key tactical advantages. Some of these came in the form of experienced individuals and veteran infantry units, but perhaps most significant was the impact on naval operations. No longer could the British expect to control the seaboard and waterways that had allowed them to invade, evacuate, and ferry troops at will. The great victory at Yorktown, more than any other, was dependent upon the French dispersing a British fleet and French materials and men who besieged Cornwallis's defensive works.
The Peace of Paris was signed in 1783, and it reflected Britain's fear of the French and their commercial challenge to Britain's global empire. It was extremely generous to the new American nation. As far as the British were concerned, making major concessions to their former colonies was unpleasant, but certainly the lesser of two evils. And there remained a hope that would partly be borne out in years to come, that although constitutional bonds had been severed, commercial and cultural relations between former mother country and her unruly dependents could be profitably sustained.
The treaty declared both parties would forget all past misunderstandings and differences and seek to secure to both perpetual peace and harmony. This was easier for diplomats and merchants than it would be for the innumerable broken families, fugitives, loyalists, veterans, and especially the large numbers of Indian tribes whose interests were completely neglected as their lands were signed away from one group of whites to another. The treaty may have marked then a military and political endpoint, but as the 1780s would show, Americans' views of how they should organize their newly won sovereignty betrayed stark social differences and perceptions of what the war had been fought for.
The American victory was won against unfavorable odds. Their war effort emerged after much trial and error and against a background of early British victories. The leadership of Washington did much to keep the Continental Army together, and he was an effective conduit through which politicians could direct the war effort. In keeping the American efforts alive for so long, Washington paved the way for politicians like Franklin to create an alliance with France that would tip the balance in America's favor.
Thank you.
Throughout the 19th and early 20th centuries, the American Revolution was understood to be a single great movement, the coming-of-age story of a nation whose people rose up as one to lay claim to the grand rights espoused in the famous documents of the Revolutionary era. We still hear echoes of this, especially in presidential speeches, in Hollywood films, and in popular culture.
My friends, we live in an age of revolution in America and in the world. And to find the answers to our problems, let us turn to a revolution that will never go old. The world's greatest continuing revolution, the American Revolution.
This nationalistic, romantic myth has been important for the United States and its identity, a way of linking together to a single history, a disparate people made up of waves of immigrants from different places, different races, and different eras. But as historians at the start of the 20th century began to perceive, the shape and the outcome of the American Revolution was not a foregone conclusion. Though lined up together on the Patriot side, the different people were fighting for different ends, looking towards different visions for America. In other words, it's helpful not to think of just one American Revolution, but to think of many.
In Pod 10, we map out some of these revolutionary ambitions and what inspired them. Only by spending time with diverse groups of people and trying to look through their eyes can we understand why historians have clashed so often in their verdicts about the revolution, and whether it was something radical and traumatic, or something conservative and restrained. We'll begin by thinking about the ways the revolution transformed politics and society, before turning to some of the changes that had far less impact, including those relating to the colonial elite, gender relations, and, to some extent, slavery. Quite what history would make of the American Revolution was a matter that troubled the founding fathers as they reached old age and started thinking about their legacy.
Who shall write the history of the American Revolution? Who can write it? John Adams, 1815.
In his interpretation, John Adams placed most emphasis on American self-liberation from Britain, a natural place to start. But declaring independence was just that, a starting point. From then on, as historian Carl Becker famously put it in 1909, the war was not about home rule, but about who would rule at home. The revolution and the war that accompanied it was a chance for poorer people to push for more power, a chance for repressed groups such as servants, slaves, women, religious minorities and Indians to try to seize opportunities and create a fairer new world. For many of them, liberty and ideas of natural rights meant much more in practice than they did in theory to the elite men and slaveholders who led the revolution.
In 1776, when Americans hastily erected new Republican constitutions for their state governments, people in every former colony had to determine who exactly was going to gain access to the rights trumpeted in the Declaration, and how a new kind of politics was going to work. What followed was an array of state governments that varied dramatically, from some that were very radical for the first time and differed enormously from earlier colonial assemblies, to others that echoed and reinstated similar people in power.
To give an example, Pennsylvania adopted an innovative, democratic, radical constitution with a stress on popular sovereignty and direct involvement in political decision-making. They got rid of property qualifications for voting or holding office, scrapped the governor and upper house, and invited members of the public into the chamber, as well as publishing all legislation for public scrutiny. This new format revolutionized politics in the state, bringing new people, interests and opportunities forward.
In contrast, Maryland's new constitution was stage-managed by a small number of very wealthy planters and not submitted to the people at large. It refused to sanction annual elections, insisted that governors and upper house members had at least £1,000 of wealth, and only enfranchised or extended the vote to 7% of its population of 300,000. The other states adopted forms of government on a spectrum somewhere between the two, though it was common for these to be overhauled and replaced as circumstances changed and the war developed. For all their differences, the new state constitutions all agreed the importance of legislators, and of having a wide franchise that represented white males of all faiths. Religious freedom, male suffrage, and an open form of representation offered a new model to the world of how ordinary citizens could participate in political life. For its time, this was unquestionably a radical development, and one which would have important consequences for how Americans related to one another, becoming less formal, more competitive, more communicative, and perhaps open to reformism of one kind or another.
However, unlike the French or Russian revolutions, there were clearly roads that the American Revolution might have travelled down and didn't. John Adams and many other colonial elites were fearful of democracy, which equated to mindless mob rule and a state of politics likely to pave the way for a future tyrant to emerge. He was unimpressed by the liberal Pennsylvania Constitution, describing it as so democratical it must produce confusion and every evil work.
As the revolution progressed, and especially after 1781, when local communities were coping with the fallout of the war and the implications of British withdrawal, the radical potential inherent in the language and rhetoric of independence began to falter in the face of the fears of the elite. Broadly speaking, there was a turn away from the more egalitarian implications and the more democratic proposals for how governments should be organized and how far citizenship should be extended.
The institution of racial slavery, for example, was seriously challenged by the revolution. Washington had reluctantly accepted blacks into the Continental Army, and they had served the Patriot side with distinction, adding fuel to the arguments of many black and white abolitionists who pointed out the hypocrisy of a republic celebrating liberty while sanctioning slavery. During and after the war, unprecedented numbers of slaves were manumitted by their owners, and a number of states, especially in the North where slaves constituted a small proportion of the workforce, passed legislation for emancipation.
But there would be a backlash in the 1780s and beyond, centered on the southern states whose white legislators ferociously defended slavery and the continuation of the slave trade. Southern whites, they argued, had fought the revolution to secure their property, and slaves were a part of that. The liberty they wanted was the liberty to own slaves and develop their landholdings. Little wonder that thousands of fugitive slaves left America with the British Army and Loyalists when they evacuated ports such as Charleston and New York, in spite of great uncertainty about their future status and whereabouts. Some would help pioneer beleaguered new imperial settlements in Nova Scotia and Sierra Leone.
Just as there were limits to the revolution's challenge to slavery, so there were other breakthroughs that were imagined but not fully realized. Women's place in politics and society, for instance, had been thrust into the spotlight by their importance during the colony's resistance and the war itself. Women were critical to the boycotts, the protests, and the war effort, radically changing their domestic manufacturing activity and offering support to units, armies, and communities. The American household became a political space, and as its traditional guardians and the key figures in raising new generations of citizens, women pressed for better recognition, education, and access to the public sphere. They were supported to some degree in this, as new colleges and curriculums were proposed, and in a few places there have been suggestions that there were more divorces, and in New Jersey, a brief window in which women voted between 1790 and 1807.
By and large, as with the state constitutions and the institution of slavery, we might best think of the American Revolution as a tsunami that swept in lots of radical social possibilities, but then retreated somewhat. It was largely thanks to the vocal efforts and physical heroics of blacks, Indians, women, and others that the wave got as far as it did, and only with new interests among historians have the voices of such marginalized groups been able to compete with those of the Founding Father. The legacy of the drive for more egalitarianism was varied, bringing major changes to political access for white males across the board, ensuring a much higher degree of religious freedom across the states, and encouraging Americans towards reformism, where it did not undermine core interests. But ultimately, they would struggle to sustain momentum in the face of elite retrenchment and worries about how to best secure the economic and constitutional viability of the United States in the 1780s, which we turn to in our next pod. The second day of July, 1776, will be the most memorable epoch in the history of America. I am apt to believe that it will be celebrated by succeeding generations as the great anniversary festival, with pomp and parade, with shows, games, sports, guns, bells, bonfires, and illuminations.
So wrote John Adams, following the adoption of Richard Henry Lee's resolution calling for a new Confederation of States and independence from Britain. Yet within 11 years, the articles that governed Lee's Confederation were no longer fit for purpose, and a group of American elites, labeled by Thomas Jefferson as an assembly of demigods, came together to formulate a new constitution that would answer the new challenges facing the United States.
Welcome to Pod 11, where the issues surrounding the shape of the government of America and the Constitution will be placed under the microscope. The Revolution had not initially demanded independence and a new form of government, but as the struggle unfolded, radical solutions became more popular. In the period up to 1787, radical voices grew louder in colonial assemblies as they were successful in the more frequent elections that were held. Old families saw their power decline as these new revolutionary figures took their place in each colony. Throughout the 1760s, groups like the Sons of Liberty had seen a transfer of power to men of a lower social class and had raised a new political consciousness. As colonies began the transition to states after 1775, debates raged between elitists and Democrats about who should hold political sway, but also about the role of a central government in their new democracy.
Until the war with Britain, Americans had identified themselves by their colonies. The war crystallized a growing sense of American identity as they were forced to fight alongside each other, share resources, and develop national markets. As British rule collapsed in 1774-75, colonies reconstituted themselves as states with republican constitutions. Mindful of the excessive power of a central government, Congress was initially given very limited powers to conduct the war. But the war served to divide as well as to unite the new states. With it came economic uncertainty and inflation, and the traditional reaction of angry colonists was to attack those merchants who sought to make a profit, whilst also demanding price fixing. This direct action threatened the legitimacy of the new state governments, and men like Robert Morris saw the benefits of not bowing down to the old-fashioned ideals of government intervention and price controls, and allowing a free market.
With this emphasis on localism, Congress found that even its limited powers were hard or impossible to enforce throughout the country. It didn't help that Congress itself was not in regular session and had no fixed home, with members not always guaranteed to turn up. Administration came through committees, and though this functioned in a way in the urgent press of military issues, victory had left something of a vacuum and a large set of debts at state and national level. The original Articles of Confederation made no provision for a head of state to negotiate with other countries, nor did it have any power to regulate trade across state lines.
Little surprise then that once war was over, states began to turn away from each other to protect their own interests, whether connected to debts, trade, or often their borders and westward expansion. New land and resources were recognized as one of the great boons of independence. Central government needed an element of control over the expanding republic, especially considering Indian threats, population spread, or disputes with foreign powers.
Although the Treaty of Paris had promised a full withdrawal from America, Britain maintained a presence in frontier outposts that allowed them to continue their fur trade with Native American tribes. They argued that this was a legitimate action since America had not yet paid their pre-war debts, nor restored loyalist property, an implicit condition in the treaty. Despite congressional appeals, states tended to ignore calls to repay the British, encouraging Britain to bold actions, including plotting with separatist Native American tribes who might destabilize America.
A similar approach was also adopted by Spain. The Spanish had wanted to continue the war, and while they had secured Florida, they viewed American encroachment into the West as unwelcome. Besides strengthening Native Americans in the interior, they could damage U.S. interests by closing the Mississippi River to American trade. Congressional attempts to broker a deal on this backfired, in part because northern and southern states held differing interests.
With the strain of state divisions and foreign entanglements, the Articles began to creak. The bulwark of the Revolution, the Continental Army, no longer existed to protect the government. In fact, the army was a potential threat when over the winter of 1782-83, officers met to discuss the fact that they were owed back pay and deserved pensions for their heroic efforts during the war. Congress was saved by General Washington, who negotiated successfully with them at Newburgh. Although soldiers once again surrounded Congress on the same issue in June 1783, forcing them to abandon Philadelphia.
The Articles of Confederation did not allow for Congress to have any tax-raising powers, and with the burden of $41 million of national debt by 1783, it was little wonder that many Americans began to call for increased centralized powers. Robert Morris helped America to meet its expenses, but called for a stronger government to set up a central bank that could manage the national debt as well as levy duties and raise taxes. His ideas were not well received in 1784, with states unwilling to cede power, despite heavy debts, high inflation, and economic crisis.
It was this economic chaos and the ensuing violence that occurred across several states in 1786 and 1787 that was to force the hand of the Federalists, who sought a stronger central power. Shays' Rebellion, an uprising of Western farmers and veterans in Massachusetts, and other protests about tax collection threatened mob rule. Washington and fellow Virginian James Madison feared that the national project was under threat from both this violence as well as from ongoing local trade disputes, which the national government was unable to resolve. Madison argued that the commitment to state politics was actually destroying the national American community.
It was Madison who called for a meeting at Annapolis to discuss commercial ties, and with the specter of violence in Massachusetts, a further meeting was agreed in Philadelphia to examine the Articles. Here, the Founding Fathers, as they became known, debated the future direction of America. Many agreed that central government should be strengthened, although not at the expense of the states. and that no single branch of government should be too powerful. The real arguments came when discussing how the states would be represented in government. The Virginia Plan, largely Madison's work, proposed a system which favored the larger states, whose populations entitled them to more representation, and where central government could be able to veto state laws. Unsurprisingly, the smaller states balked at this, and an alternative plan offered a smaller Congress with equal representation for the states.
Pragmatic compromise lay at the heart of this meeting, and Connecticut's Roger Sherman was able to propose one that was to the satisfaction of most. In mixing both plans, there was to be equal representation in the upper house, the Senate, whilst large states were to benefit from larger representation in the lower house, where all bills on taxation would begin. The boundaries between federal and state power were drawn, the new role of the president was created, and the rules for election decided. Further key compromises were needed to resolve stark differences over slavery and its future, in which the interests of blacks were sold out. Perhaps unsurprising, given the dominance of slaveholders. A proposed document laying out all this, the Constitution, was released in September 1787, with a call for the states to ratify it.
This was no foregone conclusion, as a rift emerged between the Federalists who supported it and those who preferred to see power vested in state politics. These divisions often cut across social lines, with elites wanting orderly and efficient government, while artisans, unskilled workers, and farmers tended to be supporters of state rights. They feared they would not be represented by this new government, that taxes would be punishing, and that there was a glaring omission of a Bill of Rights. Federalists had the support of Washington and Franklin, as well as large sections of the press in the cities and towns. Fear of anarchy was played upon. A few tactical concessions and careful attention to managing the public debate and the timing of ratification allowed the Federalist case to win by a tight margin. 9 states had ratified within 10 months, and by May 1790, all states had signed up to the new Constitution.
The struggle for the ratification of the new Constitution should not be seen as a struggle over revolutionary values, but instead over which values were most important. The Revolution's main goals had been to restore law and preserve the liberty of the American people from the control of an oppressive power. The Constitution created that order and gave America a foothold into international affairs. The Founding Fathers had not provided all the answers, though, and the first President and Congress would have to tread carefully after 1789. I have the honor to transmit to Your Excellency the information of your unanimous election to the office of President of the United States of America. Suffer me, sir, to indulge the hope that so auspicious a mark of public confidence will meet your approbation and be considered as a sure pledge of the affection and support you are to expect from a free and enlightened people.
These were the words Charles Thompson spoke to George Washington in April 1789, as the results of the first American election were delivered. The United States was in a precarious position. Never before had a Republican government governed such a diffuse population over such a large landmass, and the daunting task before Washington and his fellow Federalists was to prove that it could be done.
Welcome to our final pod, where we will see how the Constitution began to take shape in the early years of the new Republic. Despite misgivings,
Washington did accept the position, and he gathered around himself a knowledgeable and experienced staff, including John Adams as his vice president, Thomas Jefferson as his secretary of state, and Alexander Hamilton as his treasury secretary. These were men who were largely chosen on merit and evolved from an advisory role into a more formal cabinet. In his inaugural speech, he called for national unity and an end to the localism that was undermining political and economic security.
Washington faced many issues at the start of this first administration, not least of which was the need to cement the credibility of the new government. For all its many compromises and careful architecture, the Constitution was thin on detail. It was memorably described by historian John Murrin as a roof without walls. How the federal project and governance would actually work was often unclear, and Washington generally proceeded with due caution, mindful that any precedents he established would carry enormous weight.
Localism was not the only problem that needed attention. The United States faced an uncertain future. Huge debts of over $77 million burdened the new government and its untried constitution, putting unwelcome pressure on Washington's administration. In the absence of any real national army or navy for protection, for according to Republican thinking, a standing army was dangerous, American territory and citizens were vulnerable. British and Spanish troops were still on American soil awaiting payment, while Native American attacks plagued the frontiers and their huge, unprotected borders.
Much of Washington's early administration was devoted to working out the details of his office. He recognized there was a delicate balance between adding dignity and gravitas to the role of the president while avoiding courtly ritual. He focused on issues such as how and when to receive visitors, making certain that when he visited states, governors called on him first. He also adopted the simple title of Mr. President. These issues might seem relatively straightforward, but they went to the heart of understandings of the relative powers within government. Washington saw the executive's role as a servant of Congress, a viewpoint made easier given his frustration with direct dealings with the legislature. When senators refusing to debate the provisions of one treaty in front of him, he swore he would be damned if he went there again. Ever mindful of his duty, Washington sought self-consciously to make decisions for the good of all and did not try to influence Congress. For much the same reason, he refused to veto laws unless he felt they went against the Constitution.
The new government went a long way toward securing recognition by placating many of the Constitution's critics with the Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments collated artfully by James Madison. Freedoms of speech, religion, assembly, and the press were guaranteed, as was the right to bear arms. Congress also passed the Judiciary Act, creating the Supreme Court. The precedent set balanced this body with equal numbers of northern and southern judges, and it oversaw a network of district courts and courts of appeal.
One of the driving forces of the new administration was Alexander Hamilton, whose main task as Secretary of the Treasury was to deal with the financial chaos created by the American Revolution. States had huge war debts, inflation was high, and the economic malaise had been a major factor pushing calls for stronger central government and more fiscal powers. Hamilton saw a need to protect American industry by placing tariffs on imported goods and a tax on alcohol to pay off war debts and to fund the new government. He also called for a national bank to centralize America's financial base and tie wealth to political security, as Morris had done earlier. The Bank of the United States, which would manage the economy, would be modeled on the Bank of England and issue a more stable national paper currency.
These ideas of consolidating debts and fiscal policy were controversial because they assumed that the Constitution gave these powers to the executive. Not all agreed, though, and opposition to taking on these debts and creating a national bank was fierce. merchants and traders, largely based in the north, tended to agree with Hamilton's plans, as protection would be offered to them. Farmers, though, including southern planters such as Jefferson and Madison, opposed it on both constitutional grounds and because their goods would become harder to export when foreigners retaliated. A compromise was reached after intense discussion. Jefferson promised to persuade southern congressmen to vote for Hamilton's plan if northerners would support moving the national capital to the south. Washington himself selected the site for the future capital of Washington, D.C., not far from his home in Mount Vernon. In spite of this mutually beneficial outcome, though, the split between the Federalists of Hamilton and the Republicans of Jefferson widened.
By the end of Washington's first term, his administration had split into these two rival factions. Jefferson's Republicans wanted a weaker national government and stronger states' rights. They demanded that the economy support a nation of yeoman farmers. Hamilton's Federalist faction saw more benefit in diversifying the economy under the watchful guidance of a strong central authority. Both groups therefore disagreed on virtually all aspects of domestic and foreign policy, and much of Washington's time was spent in mediating differences in his cabinet.
Foreign policy, so often a chance to unite a nation, gave him no less a headache. The French alliance of 1778 had extensively supported the American patriots, and in the early 1790s, France expected reciprocal aid as their own revolution turned to an international war. This was a problem because Americans remained dependent upon British trade for economic development, something Hamilton was acutely sensitive to. Jefferson and the Republicans supported France and her ideals, but did not ultimately want war. Federalists and Republicans fought endlessly on this, amongst other issues, disrupting much of Washington's second term, the matter coming to a head with the arrival of a new French ambassador in April 1793.
The new ambassador's remit was to negotiate a commercial treaty with the United States to obtain the payment of some debts owed by the US to France and to authorize a tax on British merchant shipping using ships based in American ports. Genet issued commissions upon his arrival in Charleston, authorizing the holders to seize British merchant ships and their cargo for personal profit, under the protection of the French government. America had adopted a position of neutrality, though, and Genet's actions were a violation of this. Genet ignored warnings to desist from his campaign as he appeared publicly to drum up support for the French cause. The final straw came with his authorizing of the outfitting of another French pirate ship, which began to attack British shipping. The American government demanded his recall, although Federalists had pushed for his expulsion, which Jefferson ignored. Washington insisted on a policy of neutrality, and this neutrality in foreign wars became another key precedent for the fledgling republic, with the decision remaining henceforth with the president.
Relations with Britain were another divisive feature of this period. The British had not abandoned their military posts after 1783 and continued to encourage Native American attacks on settlers in the frontiers. During their war with France, they announced in 1793 that they would seize any ships trading with the French, including American ones. There was disorder in American cities, and the government commissioned several warships before sending a representative to Britain to negotiate. Washington wanted a diplomatic solution, but the results were unsatisfactory. John Jay negotiated a weak treaty that gave the United States only limited trade on the high seas and also failed to compensate for slaves taken during the Revolution. Republicans were unhappy at bargaining with an enemy, but Washington's reputation ensured that an agreement was reached. Foreign policy with Spain brought a slightly better outcome when Florida agreed to stop inciting Native American attacks on settlers. Significantly, Spain allowed American access to the Mississippi River, opening the Ohio Valley for settlement and trade.
As Washington's second term drew to a close, further disagreements between Federalists and Republicans began to take their toll. Hamilton had instituted a tax on whiskey as part of his fiscal program. This tax angered many Americans, and in 1794, resistance to this tax blew up in Pennsylvania, with attacks on tax collectors and the creation of a resistance movement. Washington saw this as a threat to the nation's existence and ordered militia from several other states into Pennsylvania to keep order. He personally oversaw the movement of troops and lent his support. He had ensured the order and maintained the primacy of the federal government. However, further splits in his cabinet emerged, with both Knox and Hamilton resigning in 1794.
As the 1796 election approached, it was clear that Washington was growing disillusioned with party politics and the attacks of the Republicans. He decided he would not stand for re-election. The Federalists and Republicans now had the chance to campaign for the presidency in the first party political election. John Adams faced Thomas Jefferson, and it was the Federalist candidate, Adams, who became the second president of the United States in 1796. Washington retired to Mount Vernon and could look back on two terms where he had balanced competing interests, brought financial stability, and maintained the neutrality required for the United States to find its way in foreign affairs. Perhaps his finest achievement was in raising the status of the presidency and securing some legitimacy in the eyes of European powers.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this program.